All right. It was an exquisite day, which I assume counts for part of our conspicuous absence here. Let's talk about Plato. I know I gave you guys a tremendous amount of information, a tremendous amount of detail on Tuesday, but I hope it was kind of helpful in trying to orient how we read this thing, right? And how you begin reading and begin to realize that every moment in this text is arguing, right? There's every moment. I mean, to be honest, some of the speeches you can kind of maybe, you know, move through a little faster here and there. But fundamentally, this is an incredibly dense text, right? And one thing I'm trying to teach you is to be thorough, to read carefully, and to begin to see that be able to read every move, to realize that every component of the text is some kind of symptom, some kind of sign, some kind of mark, some kind of point of inflection, that every moment in the book is argumentative. Right? And that it's building a very specific argument. So, when we last left our hero, Socrates had asked Phaedrus to read the speech of Lysias. Right? This is, again, a strange moment typographically, right? It's one thing we got out of McLuhan, to read the marks of the text, to read the textuality, the texture of the text. Right? And that all of a sudden we get this very strange sort of offset text. Like it's a different grammar from the rest of the dialogue. Who's speaking here? Who speaks here? Right? There's a grammar of who's speaking most of the time, right? You get that Phaedrus period and Socrates period. Right? And we assume those guys are speaking. I think that's pretty safe to assume. But at this point, it gets a little bit strange. Right? Most explicitly, we have the presence of another character. We have Lysias, which is one of the strangest components of writing. Right? Writing undoes our individuality. That's what we've said all along. Right? That writing undoes not just the individuality of the speaker, right? Because it is this texture of all these other words, these quotes that aren't ours. Right? That's what Bart says. We are a tissue of quotations. Right? So not only does writing undo our individuality as people, it undoes the individuality of the text. So here's a text, presumably, that's mapping the dialogue between Phaedrus and Socrates, but all of a sudden, here's Lysias. It's the strangest thing about the written text. And here we are, right, reading this written text that's Plato and Socrates and Phaedrus and now Lysias. The weird thing about text, and it will happen throughout here, is that about the written word, is it has a kind of spectral quality to it. Right? It functions a little bit like a seance. You conjure the dead. You conjure the not present. Now, right, when you pick up any text, when you pick up Plato, you conjure Plato. Now you have Plato. Plato's with you right now. He's talking to you. Doesn't that seem weird? Right? When we're reading all your little papers at home, you're with us. Right? It's a little strange. We can do kind of what we want. Right? Different laws kind of apply to what we can do to your papers, what we can do to you, but it is part of you. It's right? It's constitutive of you. So all of a sudden, here's a conjuring, and this figure of conjuring is going to repeat. And it's this conjuring, in a sense, this presence and not presence of the written word. Right? Lysias is both present and not present. Does that make sense? When we're reading his speech, he's both there. We're hearing him speak, but at the same time, he's not there. And it's this presence, not presence, in a way that that Socrates is going to speak to and be a bit ambivalent about. Right? At some point, he's going to argue, he's going to constitutively say, I want you to be self-present. The speaking man is self-present to himself. And writing, you're absent. Right? And he's going to poo-poo writing sort of for the absence it creates. Does that make some sense? Right? The absence of the father is the figure he'll use. Right? The written text doesn't have a father. Does that make some sense, right? That it's sort of orphaned, right? And so hence a kind of absence. But Socrates himself will constantly do this conjuring. He will be a great conjurer. The person who will argue consistently for self-presence will constantly be the conjurer of absences. Right? So here we go, the speech of Lysias. And again, I don't know who's speaking here. To me, this is a beautifully ambivalent moment, which is performed throughout this text of who's speaking. Who's speaking? Who's speaking? All right. So it's Lysias. And he says, you know, I claim I should not fail to obtain what I ask merely because I'm not a lover of yours. And what's interesting here, and I usually just skip over the speech because it's so bad, and one thing that's so conspicuous about it is how bad it is. Right? Look at the first word of all the different paragraphs. Right? It's again, again, moreover, again, 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 moreover, again. He's not really arguing. He's just listing a bunch of shit. Right? I mean, if you had it in a paper like this, you wouldn't get a very good grade. Right? But one thing I noted this time that I had not noted previously is that one sentence. I claim that I should not fail to obtain what I ask merely because I'm not a lover of yours. It's this beautiful performative moment, right? Where his argument is about the non-lover and the relationship between the lover and the non-lover and about who should give in to whom. And he has pitched and framed rhetoric itself and argument and persuasion in terms of seduction, in terms of love and lust and flirtation. Right? It's this beautiful performative moment. He's like, yay, you don't just gotta, you know, I don't ask merely that you buy this, you know, because we're lovers or not, right? Which is precisely his topic, right? So he's framed, again, the seduction of the audience in terms of the seduction of a lover. Does that make sense? Right? And this whole dialogue will kind of do that repeatedly. So, right? Also, all the discussions of seduction, of love and lust will be a kind of mirroring of the discussions of rhetoric and philosophy, of writing and speech that happen in the second half of the dialogue. Okay? So I assume when you're reading the speech, you're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's sort of a crappy speech. Right? And we actually have to read it twice. Right? It gets repeated. But what is the basic argument? Because the argument is strange in that it won't change. Everybody uses the same argument. What is the basic argument? Why should one submit to a non-lover and not a lover? Anyone want to make a stab? See, Felix, this is what I have to put up with. You want to answer?
No.
Okay. Remy. Why? What's the argument here? What's Lysias' argument? Right, why? What's the argument? Lysias argues that you should submit to the non-lover, right? Why?
Because non-lover is not based on rational
thought. Thank you. Right.
Yeah, it's based on friendship.
Right. It's rational, right? There's something irrational about love, right? There's something mad. Right? And the role of madness will become important. And Socrates will make a very nice move where he'll distinguish kinds of madness. And he'll say, sure, his move later will be, I buy your argument, but I'm going to make a different kind of distinction about it. And what we'll learn about argument, right, that we'll get three versions of this argument, right? There are three speeches about this. And they all make that same premise. They all agree to that. So what is it that makes one speech different than another? Simply the emphasis. Certain parts get played up, certain parts get played down. Socrates says, sure, you're mad, but madness is good. Right? It's all, you will never see evidence. You'll never see proof. What you'll get in these arguments is this kind of morphing of emphasis, this distribution of an argument. Does that make some sense? Right, we'll get to there. We'll get there, right? Because this text is an argument and about rhetoric. While this text poo-poos rhetoric, it is in fact an exemplary rhetorical text. All right, so the dialogue ends. I mean, the speech ends. And Lysias says, well, Socrates, how does the speech seem to you? Isn't it marvelously eloquent, especially in its use of language? Right? And that's precisely what's at stake in this dialogue. Right? Eloquence. Eloquence versus truth. If you speak well, what does it mean to speak well? Right? Are you speaking of the world, or are you just speaking beautifully? Right? And so the speech ends, and sure enough, Phaedra says, isn't it eloquent in its use of language? But what is the use of language? That's precisely the topic of this dialogue, precisely the topic of this text. And Socrates is hilarious. Wonderfully, my friend, to the point of quite overcoming me. This was due to you, Phaedrus. I was watching you and observed how you were enjoying the speech as you read it. And because I know that you understand such things better than I followed your guidance and entered into your ecstasy, my holy companion. Again, is he serious or not serious? What is it that's happened here? How has Socrates read the scene? What's really at stake here? Right, you get in this argument, Socrates is like, nah, he's into Phaedrus. He's watching Phaedrus, and he's like, Phaedrus, I'm watching you, and frankly, I got a little, you know, you piqued my interest, if you know what I mean. You know, I was aroused. I entered into your ecstasy. Right? So there's clearly this kind of erotic performative component to texts that Socrates is kind of game for. Right? But at the same time, is he serious? Is he not? Right, my holy companion. And what does Phaedrus say? So you want to make fun of it. And this is the fun, this is the key Socratic moment right here. This is Socrates in a nutshell. Do you really think I'm joking? Don't I seem serious? That is the ultimate, most explicit enunciation, utterance of irony. Don't I seem serious? It's precisely the relationship between what seems and what is that is irony. Socrates will never be one or the other. He's never either joking as if joking were opposed to the serious. He's never serious as if we're opposed to the joking. He's always both. He's joking, he's serious. That's the ironic position. Right? I told you that irony is this fundamentally religious posture. Irony fundamentally points to the inadequacy of language, the inadequacy of the body, the inadequacy of this mortal coil to hold the infinitude of life, to hold the truth, to hold the divine within its tender frame. Right? And so when I'm ironic, I'm necessarily being serious. What I'm saying is, this mortal life, I can't take it that seriously. I can't really submit to it once and for all. Why? Because there's a whole nother life. There's an infinite life. There's the life of truth that you can't see. So the only way I can express that life seriously is to take this life not seriously. So play, for Socrates, irony becomes the only way to actually live seriously. And we'll see that in his argument as we go along. So do you really think I'm joking? Don't I seem serious? Right? And again, this will come back to us at the end of the dialogue, I think, in sort of explicitly. Socrates is going to say, let's be humble for a moment. Let's be serious for a moment at the end of the text. Let's be serious here and say that nothing written is taken seriously. There's going to be a hilarious moment where he seems like he's going to stop all the joking, right, and end with this kind of a reverent attitude and this prayer. But I see the same irony. Right? It's taking a slightly different tone, but I find the exact same irony, almost more explicitly at the end, with this holy reverence right at the end. And then Phaedrus can't deal with it at all. Don't joke, Socrates. Tell me truly. That's what's at stake. Can I tell you something truly? Can truth be told? Right? That's what's at stake for Socrates. Can I ever tell you anything truly? Is perhaps the only way I can tell you something truly to not tell you truly, but to be ironic, to joke. That's why Phaedrus and Socrates, I think Socrates understands Phaedrus. I don't think Phaedrus ever gets Socrates. Right? Right there. He's like, he demands one or the other. Right? Phaedrus, I will tell you now, learns nothing in this dialogue. Phaedrus is not the student in this pedagogy. He is not the student in this text. The student of this text is you, the reader. Phaedrus is a bad student. He doesn't learn anything. He's persuaded by Socrates. If you map the narrative arc of this, Lysias comes in as a rhetorician in favor of Lysias, and he ends being seduced by Socrates. Right? There's a direct conversion of Lysias, right, from rhetoric to philosophy, from lust to love, right? And it begins, you know, you can see it, and it seems like perhaps that is the trajectory that's mapped for us as readers, that we're supposed to identify with Phaedrus and be converted, right, from the ways of lust, the ways of the body, the ways of rhetoric, the ways of sophistry, to the holy ways of religion and truth and philosophy. But I want to suggest that that's, I mean, look at Phaedrus. He's a fucking, he's a freaking moron, right? He's a moron. Yeah. Exactly. That what we learn to read, we are taught to read in a way performatively. We're taught to recognize irony. We're taught to read and understand irony, right? That we at that last moment in the text where it says, "Don't take anything written seriously," and you're reading it. At that moment, the two different kinds of readers are separated from each other, right? The reader who takes it at its word, right, and who identifies with Phaedrus, right, and it's basically the classical philosopher who just takes things literally. And then there's the person who's learned, actually through the text, never to take anything seriously and to understand the performative component, the how within the what. So when you get to that moment where you're reading something that says never take anything written seriously, it's such a hilarious performative contradiction. Right? How can you read something that says don't take this seriously? Well, then I can't take you seriously, then I shouldn't take this seriously. Right? The reader who gets that moment is the reader who's learned. Right? And Phaedrus never gets it. Right? Phaedrus is this kind of is almost a negative model of how to learn. He's not the ideal student. You are the student. This whole text is a performative pedagogy that teaches you how to live ironically, how to recognize irony, if not in fact to live it. Because irony fundamentally is a life. So back to our dialogue. And so poor Phaedrus, right? He's a bozo. He's always univocal. Right? He can never be dialogic. He never occupies those two positions the way Socrates does. And he's always, are you serious or are you not serious? And the answer is, both. Right? Phaedrus can't handle that ambivalence, can't handle that dual charge, can't handle irony. Right? He needs one or the other. He says, please, don't joke, Socrates. Tell me truly, friend to friend, do you believe that any other Greek could have spoken more impressively, more copiously on the same subject? And then Socrates brings out an argument with which we are all familiar. How's that? Are we to praise it on the grounds of the author's relevance? So here's Socrates pulling a weird move, right? Because again, throughout this text, he will be ambivalent about the authority over your own words. In some way, he'll sort of poo-poo writing, he'll disdain the written word, because it does kill the author. Right? But here he is wanting to kill the author. He's saying, what, I should judge the speech based on the author's relevance? And he distinctly is here participating in our celebration of the death of the author. Does that make some sense? Right? This is what, right? Are you and I to praise the speech on the grounds of the author's relevance, or rather only on this score? The language was clear and precise, turned out in accurately balanced periods. But if we are to praise it for saying what it ought, I can do so only for your sake. My insignificance failed to grasp it. I listened to it merely as a piece of rhetoric. Right? And there you get the classical dismissal of rhetoric, merely rhetoric. And it's that's that conception of rhetoric that we still hear today, right? That when a politician speaks, we say, oh, it's just his rhetoric. Right? We assume that's bullshit. It's not really serious. It's not what counts. So Socrates is like, okay, I'll treat it as merely rhetoric, not for what it ought to say, right? In a way, this whole class has been around, right, this ought, this notion of what is the right thing to say. And how do you know the right thing to say, right? What I've tried to argue to you is that rhetoric does have a right thing to say, but that right thing to say is not exterior to the discourse, but is immanent to it. Which is very, very strange, right? So when there's different kinds of ought. And this is what Socrates is bringing to the fore. What ought we to say? What ought we to say? You might make a beautiful speech, but is that what you were supposed to do? Is that what you ought to do? Is that the moral, ethical imperative of what you should say? Or was it merely good rhetoric? Right? But what's weird about Socrates is he'll never give us a moral code. He never will. He doesn't have one. Anytime anyone claims to have a moral position, he'll be like, are you sure? Are you sure? How could you know that? How could you know that? Right? Because anything expressed in language necessarily fails. That's the ironic position. Right? So if you're, how can your moral code be written down? How can you actually have a code? Right? Because then it would be written and enunciated and it would fail. It couldn't possibly speak to the truth. Right? So where does this ought come from? And what is the ought for Socrates? Right? Remember the Dissalogo. The Dissalogo is such a great text because it constantly has an ought. That's good for them. That's good for them. He has multiple oughts. Say the word ought enough and it really gets weird. Right? And it's one of these very strange words that doesn't ever seem to really be a word. Right? It doesn't seem ever really cohere, right? It's almost like a newborn. It hasn't cooked yet. Ought. You know what I'm saying? It's a very strange word to me. So I listened to it merely as a piece of rhetoric, and you know what? I don't think that was too good. He's just like, that's ridiculous. It's outstanding. And Socrates says, here, I must cease to agree with you. You must know that ancient history has produced lots of people who talked about it. Phaedra says, who are they? And again, here we get the first time Socrates will do this, and this will happen a bunch in the text. He says, at the moment, I can't tell you, but I'm quite sure I heard it somewhere. From the fair Sappho. Right before we get into the next part, Socrates, throughout this dialogue, there's going to be this nice little refrain of him, his inability to remember. He can never remember anything. He's constantly like, I don't know. But what will be his critique of writing at the end? His critique of the written word is that it gets rid of our memory. Why? Because it externalizes things, right? For instance, you know, I talk to Lauren Green. I talk to Lauren Green on the phone constantly. Programmed into my phone, I have no idea. No idea what his phone number is. No idea. I don't know one number of his phone number. I don't know the area code. I have no idea what his phone number is. Right? I talk to him all the time. Right? Because it's externalized. It's written down. I don't need to know it. I don't need to remember it. Right? And that, at the end of the text, will be the Socratic argument against writing. Right? That it ruins your memory. But here's Socrates, who can never remember anything. Right? So if he doesn't write stuff down, how come he can't remember anything? But then it's strange, because the thing he can't remember are always the written texts, which he doesn't want to remember anyway, which he doesn't think are serious. So you get this another ironic moment, this ambivalent moment, right, where he can't remember anything, as if he's a guy who's constantly writing things down. At the same time, the thing he can't remember is nothing he should have had to remember, because it doesn't really matter, because it was written down. You see what I'm saying? Right? The thing he can't remember are written texts. Written texts are not serious. What difference do they make? What he's interested in is men directly in front of him. He never really has exchanges with women. I don't think he has any exchanges with women. Who? Diets. I knew one of you would know that. Where is that?
It's in the symposium.
Oh, really? There's a woman in the symposium.
She teaches
him erotics.
Right.
Really? Yeah, symposium to me is one of those texts that I get like halfway through and I'm so overwhelmed with how hilarious and insane it is that I can't continue. There's a lot of things like that. I can't read them because they're too good. And the symposium is one of them. Everyone, they all sit around and get drunk. And each person at the table gives a different speech on the theory of love. And it gets really elaborate and insane. And they get drunker and drunker. It's really, it's way over the top. When I got to that part of my screenplay, I didn't know what to do. It got overwhelming to me. I had to kind of stop. And it's all men. So I was like, okay, you got to sell this to Hollywood. How do you do that? I was like, I don't know. They like those kind of stories. But there's women, it turns out. All right, so Socrates is in a strange position. He likes to talk to people. He doesn't need to remember things. But at the same time, he can't remember things. So again, you get this dual moment, this ambivalent moment, where his lack of memory is a symptom of somebody who writes. So it's as if he's a speechwriter. It's as if he's a book writer. He can't remember anything. And so he critiques writing, but then he seems to be clearly, he must be some kind of writer. He can't remember anything. But at the same time, the things he can't remember are things you shouldn't need to remember, because they're written texts. Right? So again, the written word will have this sort of dual role constantly to him. Right? Vincent.
Up inside.
on the same line. So it shows that he's going to take part in this economy of saying the same thing.
Yes. Right, very good. And we'll get to that, because it's hilarious. He gives the same the whole role of the speech is just hilarious, if you step back. He performs the classic rhetorical exercise of arguing both sides of the case, too. He performs the rhetorician, right? So Vincent's point is that he's going to repeat the very thing he critiques Lysias for, he's going to do again. He says the same thing multiple ways. He repeats himself. So Socrates is going to do the exact same thing. Socrates will play the rhetorician constantly. He'll play the role of the sophist, even when he's critiquing sophistry. Right? It's why you always have to look at the how. Right? You just listen to what he says, you won't actually get the argument. Right? This is the first moment we'll see him, his inability to remember. Right? He'll say, from the fair Sappho, who's great, if you ever want to read great classical poetry, perhaps, or the wise Anacreon, or one of the prose writers. Prose writers are not people we need to remember. He wants to remember ideas, he wants to remember truth, but you don't got to remember prose writers. But then again, he can't remember them. Right? So it's, again, this dual sort of strange kind of ambivalent moment for him. And do you know why I suppose so? My dear boy, there is something welling up inside me which makes me feel that I could speak in different terms and not inferior ones on these same lines. I'm quite aware that it is not from myself that such ideas come. They can only come, I suppose, from some other source, flowing in through my ears, filling me like a pitcher, though again, because of my stupidity, I can't remember how and from whom I've heard them. Isn't that a little bit weird? Right? Here's again this guy who will argue for the self-presence of words, the self-presence of the spoken word. Right? That you're the author of your own words, you're the authority over your own words. And here he's like, I'm an empty pitcher. Words just come to me. They just flow right through me. I'm only a medium. I'm not the authority. I'm not the author. I'm just a medium. Right? We saw it on the very first page of the dialogue when he quotes Pindar. It's the first time we'll see this kind of conjuring of other voices. Here is Socrates again, conjuring other voices. Right? Things speaking through him. It's not him speaking. You're looking at this guy speaking. He's like, it's not me speaking. It's a very strange moment. Right? But that is the oddity of the written word. And what I've been trying to argue, the weird argument I'm trying to give you, is that the written word is also the spoken word for Socrates. Right? That in his speaking, right, just when he quotes Pindar in quotations, he's speaking, but he is writing. He's performing the act of writing, which multiplies your individuality and disseminates you through the body of language. Right? That writing, and again, if anybody cares, I'm just giving you Derrida's argument. And you will read, this is another guy you will read in rhetoric that probably runs through the rhetoric department, Jacques Derrida, who made this phrase deconstruction very popular. And what I'm giving you is his argument, very explicitly. Right now, my argument will exceed his. This moment, where the spoken word is already the written word. Right? We can't neatly distinguish the spoken word from the written word. That if we all agree that the written word is always this quotation, always this conjuring of other voices, these words which will never have been our own. Right? This distance, this self-distancing from ourselves. When you turn in a paper to me and I take it and you walk away, I still have you here. Right? Writing enacts, inaugurates a kind of self-distancing. Right? The same way nails, when you get your hair cut. Right? Isn't it freaky to see your hair on the floor? Isn't that a strange moment? Like, that's my hair, it's on the floor, and then it's in the garbage. It always freaks me out. And I clearly cut my own hair. And when I put it in the garbage can, it always freaks me out. There's always that, am I dead? What am I doing in the garbage can? Right? It's that self-distancing, kind of alienating, right? Writing has that same moment, right? It enacts a kind of distance between you and yourself. What is happening here is that will turn out to always have been the case, even in the spoken word. Spoken word in that way is not different from the written word. We'll see that enacted again here in a minute. So Phaedrus is like, okay, dude, lay it on me. And then Socrates, he jumped down. He's like, have you taken me seriously, Phaedrus? Because to tease you, I attacked your beloved. And Phaedrus is like, buddy, you better lay it on me. And in fact, if you don't, I'm going to force you to. All right, it's a very strange turn their little flirtation takes. And so it verges a little bit on date rape. Right? says, make up your mind that we shan't leave this place until you speak out what you said you had in your breast. We're alone, this place is deserted, and I'm younger and stronger than you. So you'd better decide to pay attention and to my urging and speak voluntarily rather than under compulsion. Very strange turn here, right? But Phaedrus is a man of, he's a rhetorician at this point, right? And he's lustful, right? He's a man of the flesh. He's not, right? I mean, what we get here, violence is, of course, one kind of persuasion, right? And many would argue that the violent moment is the moment where true argument has collapsed. But of course, it's still a component of persuasion, right? I want you to do something. I put a gun to your head. Right? It compels you to do that thing. So here we're getting one kind of extreme moment of argument, of one component of argument, right? Which is the violent. And it's kind of yucky. All right. And Socrates says, but dear Phaedrus, I shall make myself ridiculous, an amateur beside a trained professional. This, again, is important. Right? We've seen this in McLuhan, this distinction between the amateur and the professional. But when at the end of the dialogue, the second half of this dialogue, Socrates will begin critiquing the schools of sophistry. Right? And what he really will be doing is saying, how can you have a school where you teach rhetoric? How can you learn rhetoric from a set of rules? That doesn't make any sense. Right? How can I teach you to say, always say the right thing in this classroom, and then you go and say the right thing? What kind of rules would I give you? Right? What Socrates recognizes is that to be a good rhetorician, you have to be in the world, of the world, right? That there might be a function of a kind of pedagogy and a learning, but that you can't possibly learn to be a good speaker in a classroom. Okay? You actually have to go and speak. You have to learn from experience. So what Socrates will do is critique the professional rhetorician. Right? And so his critique of rhetoric here, I think, needs to be tempered, because it's not as much a critique of rhetoric per se as it is a critique of professionalism. And that in this weird moment, McLuhan and Socrates, at this one moment, become odd kind of buddies, right? In this will to be the amateur, the will to be the person who's living through this life, rather than the person who tries to abstract this life into a set of rules, into a dogma, into a set of guidelines. Does that make some sense? Right? Lysias is a professional rhetorician. He's followed all the proper etiquette. He's followed all the proper structure of what a speech should be. He knows all the rules. Socrates is like, I'm not a professional. I'm just a guy. Here I am. We're on the street. We're out in the garden. We're out, you know, by the lake, by the river. Right? I'm not a professional. But that precisely will be his claim to truth, that he's not a professional. Phaedrus says, you got to stop it. You got to stop it. Socrates says, whoa, alas, wretch. How well you've discovered how to compel a lover of words to carry out your commands. Again, a lover of words, a lover of words. Right? What does it mean to be a lover of words? What do you love? What do you love in those words? Right? Is he getting it on with the words? Or does he love the words because they relate to the truth? What does he want from these words? What makes him a lover of words? And then Socrates again pulls this weird stuff. He says, I shall speak with my head covered to rush through it as quickly as I can. I'm afraid that if I catch your eye, I may be ashamed and falter. So here he literally kills himself as author. Right? He effaces himself. Right? Puts a bag over his head. I don't know where he got a bag from. I don't know what he's over his head. But right, puts something over his head. It's a little bit weird, this scene, isn't it? It's like I'm going to speak, but I'm going to cover my head. And Phaedrus is sitting there listening to him speak. He's got like a towel over his head. It's a little bit weird, don't you think? And then it gets weirder. And Socrates says, come then, clear-voiced muses, whether you have received this name from the quality of your song or from the musical race of the Ligurians, come and join in telling the tale, which my dear friend here forces upon me in order that his friend, whom he has always believed to be eloquent, may now seem to him even more so. This is such a strange architecture of voices. You got the muses. And Socrates, I'm not speaking. Muses, you speak to me. But then it's Lysias forcing it on me so that Lysias will appear eloquent. Right? It's a seance. Right? It's this weird seance. Well, now all of a sudden we have muses. We have Lysias. All these people are present coming through Socrates' mouth. Socrates is not self-present to himself. There's now a multiplicity of voices. Right? There's a veritable chorus speaking that he has summoned. right? And it's such a hilarious, strange chain. I love that. My dear friend here forces upon me in order that his friend, whom he has always believed to be eloquent, may now seem to him even more so. Right? It's a weird chain, right? A weird chain of deferral. Okay. Now, once again, we get this very strange moment. Socrates' first speech. Okay. We get this sort of, again, a strange typographical moment. Okay. And what's weird here? Is Socrates' speech written down? How could he have written it down? What do you think? He went behind the tree, wrote it down, came back? What's strange here is that Socrates' speech and Lysias' speech function in the text identically. Right? They both become written texts. They both become these speeches that are written, even though Lysias' is literally, apparently, on some kind of scroll, on some kind of parchment. It's being read. And Socrates is giving a speech here, too. Right? But his is coming, you know, spontaneously. Right? It's coming right out of him. So presumably he's not reading a speech. Right? But somehow he's not self-present to himself. Right? There's all these other things coming through him. Words are coming out of him. But we're reading it, and it functions the same as Lysias's. Right? Meaning, again, the written word. What's nice about this text is that it takes the written word and sort of obliges it to be written. It takes the spoken word and obliges it kind of written. In this weird moment, you can't escape the written word here. Right? This... If I'm trying to argue to you, that Plato's trying to argue to you that the spoken word is always already infused with the written word, right? That this distinction between written and spoken will never have been so sure of itself, never been so solid, that in fact to speak is really the same as to write. This text performs that at this point, right? Because there's no way to make his speech all of a sudden spoken, to distinguish it from Lysias's. Right? The written word kind of metabolizes the spoken word. Does that make any sense? It's the same argument I was trying to make about the quotation mark. Quotation marks are a purely visual mark, purely written mark. There's no way to speak them. Right? So when they're in the text, it's a moment in which the text insists on itself. In some sense, the moment you see those quotation marks that can't be spoken, this Platonic dialogue means a fundamentally written text, right? If you were to perform it on stage, right, those quotation marks would never make it to the stage. How would they be there? They're a written thing. You guys have no idea what I'm talking about. But it's such a great, nasty, beautiful little moment, right? Where I'm trying to give you this one tiny detail and argue why you could read the whole text this way, right? You see this strange mark in the text. Right? And you want to argue, someone wants to come along and argue, well, this dialogue is really a transcription. It's a transcription of something that was spoken between Socrates and Phaedrus. Right? It's not really a written text. The written text is just a marker, a reminder of what was spoken. Right? And so you should be able, presumably if this were performed live, like a play, we might get the more real thing. Does that make some sense? You could see that argument maybe? Right? But these quotation marks will never make it in. Right? Neither will this weird thing that says Socrates' first speech. It'll never make it into the play you're putting on stage. Why? Because it's written down. There's no way to speak it. It's a purely visual mark. It's a purely written mark. That means you can never actually, finally, adequately perform this as a play because this is a fundamentally written text. If you understand that, then you're done. You can skip Derrida. Wrote a whole lot of books saying that over and over again. Although he writes better than I speak. Okay. So we get this weird moment, Socrates' first speech. I think last time I taught this text, someone had pointed out to me the difference in the title of the speech from Lysias's. And I don't know how much you want to make of it. The first one is the speech of Lysias, and this is Socrates' first speech. And one's a possessive. Right? And one's an of. Right? Isn't it of? Yeah. The speech of Lysias, and this is Socrates' first speech. Someone wanted to make a nice argument about that. I thought it was a good catch.
Something
Say that again.
It's Socrates' first speech.
Yeah.
And that marker of first within the chronology or the temporality of the...
Oh, that's really good. That's for real. That's insane.
Because he doesn't know he's going to get
right. another speech. That's hilarious. You understand? Do you understand, Vincent? That's a great, great read, right? That it says Socrates' first speech, but to whom is it the first speech? Only to the person who's already read the whole dialogue. Right? Phaedrus and Socrates don't know there's going to be a second speech. Temporally, in terms of the dialogue, right? You understand? Right? So it's a point at which this will already have not have been written. It will already have been read. In order to call it Socrates' first speech, this text was not only written, but read. Yeah, first sir. Oh yeah. So why the possessive versus the of? You're saying what's at stake in the of versus the possessive? Anyone want to proffer an argument? Why does it say the speech of Lysias and here it says Socrates' first speech? Okay, but then what is it about the of that makes that possession? As opposed to the apostrophe. Good, 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 right? There seems to be a more of a personalization, yeah.
Well, Socrates says that written words are faster than the abstraction possessive because he is speaking it in person.
Right. Good. Good, 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 right? Maybe that's the distinction they're trying to draw, maybe, between the fact that Lysias' speech was written down, Socrates has spoken, yeah. That's very nice, right? That's very nice, right? That here speech takes precedence, and here Socrates is the first word, right? And the emphasis here is on Socrates as a person as opposed to the emphasis on the speech. That's sharp. I like that. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, if we were Greek scholars, we could probably make a whole other argument here, right? And again, I sat through a Greek seminar once. There would be. Oh, because they don't have of, right? It's all,
they don't,
the word is inflected.
It would be a genitive.
Right.
Possessive.
Right.
There are two types of possessives, but I'm not sure.
Okay. It is, again, I tell you, it's a hilarious moment of taking a classic seminar. And the class seminar I took was open to rhetoric students, to non-classics students, and it was still hilarious, the kind of detail they paid, the attention they paid to definitions of words. It's just insane, the amount of time spent flipping through dictionaries. Be careful when you tread into a classics class.
I was just going to follow up on it. Because when you read the massage, you had a hand, you know, she wasn't trying to think too much. This is one of those things where it's just the result of how the text is written.
Of course. Oh, no, of course. I mean, that's what one of the beautiful moments, though, of rhetorical critique is you could say, yeah, it's just a translation issue. But at the same time, it's there. Every accident matters. Every typo matters. Right, and sometimes the typos, like medium as a massage, becomes the argument. Everything matters, right? William Burroughs, who we didn't unfortunately get to read, or really wanted to read, Immortality, he says there's no such thing as an accident. There's no such thing. You are what you do. It doesn't happen accidentally. Accidentally drop that. It's not that you did it on purpose. It's that you are the person who dropped that. You are your fate. There's no such thing as an accident. Right, which is an intense thing for a man to say who accidentally shot his wife, right? And it's why he's obsessed with the notion of accident, right? Because there was a gun accident and he killed his wife. And it's kind of this unbelievable moment that changes his whole life. He wasn't yet a writer at that point, right? And so now he claims he writes to try to understand, to depossess himself. He thinks he was possessed at this moment. Why else would he have shot her in the middle of the head? Right? The shot glass on top. Right? They were doing a William Tell trick. He shot her right in the head. It's a tragic, terrible, terrible story. Right? And that's the same guy who says, it wasn't an accident. I didn't do it on purpose, but it wasn't an accident. Happens in that middle place where you are your fate. Yeah. Right. Yes. Yeah, very good. I think it's a similar argument here. Yeah, I think that's a good way to read that. I think that works. All right, so here's this weird moment where Socrates is going to begin speaking. This weird title, Socrates' first speech, that can't possibly be there. Right? No one says that at that moment, presumably. Do you think Socrates is about to begin? He says, Socrates' first speech. I don't know why not. I mean, there's soccer, and then all this text that comes after, and we assume he's the one speaking. But I guess he doesn't say that. Again, it's another moment where the written text is essentially a written text. For some reason, that moment doesn't get spoken. It's just written. Your thing was hilarious. It's really smart. I love that. I don't know why I never caught that. It's very good. All right, so here he's conjured all these weird voices. He's got people speaking to people, speaking to people, these muses. He's got his head covered. This is a weird scene. All right? And then he begins, and what does he do? Once upon a time. He's going to begin an argument with once upon a time. What's going on here? What does that sound like? Who does it sound like to us? Who else begins once upon a time? It's this weird moment, right? It's, you know, Nietzsche spends a lot of his time arguing with Socrates, but it's precisely because he feels so close to him. Nietzsche only spends time arguing with people he respects, right? If he doesn't have time for you, you won't get mentioned. If you get mentioned, it means he thought you were worth the time. He spends a lot of time talking about Socrates because, like Socrates, or Nietzsche, like Socrates, Socrates like Nietzsche, digs play. They privilege play over truth, right? That's probably be the most common thing that runs through all of our texts, right? Is the privileging of play, the privileging of a kind of movement, a betweenness that doesn't ever resolve, an endless movement, right? Like the dogs smelling each other's asses and chasing each other, right? And it won't stop. It won't stop until some owner comes along, blows a whistle, and says, "We got to go home," right? There's no winner or loser, just play. So once upon a time, again, this thing is so weird. This is like stories within stories. We're reading a story that gets talked about itself. I mean, the very topic, again, of their speeches is what's happening between them, the seduction of a non-lover, right? I mean, it's a very strange moment. So once upon a time, there was a boy, or rather a youth of great beauty, who had a large number of lovers. Again, he's talking about Phaedrus. It's just this weird moment where the thing folds back on itself. And the dialogue speaks its own happening, right, within itself. And one of them was a certain cunning fellow who had persuaded the boy that he didn't love him, though he really loved him all the time. Is that Socrates? Is that Lysias? It's kind of both of them. And on one occasion of his courtship, he tried to convince the lad of this precise point, that it's better to give one's favor to a non-lover than to a lover. And this is what he said. And now we get quotation marks. This is just such a, talk about the infinite deferral, the distancing from any possibility of a truth, right? It's not my word speaking. It's a speech in which there was a story, in which there's a character who makes a speech, right? And again, this quotation mark that can't possibly be spoken, right? It's an insane moment. So what does he do that's different than Lysias? Well, he just kind of makes the implicit argument of Lysias as explicit. He says, yeah, the difference between a non-lover and a lover, let's talk about our terms. And basically, one's crazy and one's not, and it's better to not be crazy, right? And we'll see at the top of 17, he'll say, again, we must observe that in each of us, there are two ruling and guiding principles which we follow wherever they may lead. One of them is an innate desire for pleasure, the other an acquired opinion which strives for the best. Okay? This is, it's a bizarre argumentative moment, right? Because he says we must observe that in each of us. We must observe that we have these two impulses. What kind of argument is this? He's just sort of asserting it, right? It's a beautiful form of argumentation. Again, we're really getting real rhetoric here. It's not premised on proofs, right? He's not really giving us a syllogism. He's not really arguing, right? I mean, I guess in a way he's giving us a principle and then deriving the best thing from it. But he's just making shit up, right? There's two things in us, two ruling and guiding principles. But this notion of our duality, of our dialogic, our two logics, will pervade his thinking. We'll come back again in the second speech. Right? We are two things. And in fact, we're three things. We'll find out in the second speech. Right? I have one horse, I have another horse, and then I'm the charioteer. Right? There's the two things and then the thing in between the two things. That is where everything happens for Socrates, the space in between. One thing, the two opposites, and then the negotiation between them. That's where life happens. So he gives this kind of speech, same old shit, we know the argument. Phaedrus says, he says, Phaedrus, do you think that I am inspired? Phaedrus says, certainly. You are dominated by an unusual eloquence. It's again a great use of the passive voice there. You are dominated. It's also the weird notion of being inspired. He says, yes, I'm inspired. I'm inspired. To be inspired puts you in the passive voice. Right? It's very strange to be inspired.
Inspired is it? Also just like a flowing in, right?
Yes, right. It's complicated, right? So let's actually talk about that for 1 minute, to be inspired. It is a kind of entering, right? So it's something like when you're inspired, you get filled up. Socrates says, I'm a pitcher. Right? It's not the coming out of me. To be inspired is actually to have something come into you. Very strange. Right? You're kind of passive towards inspiration. Right? In fact, that's the only way to speak it. You say, I am inspired. You can only say it passively. You could say you inspire, but that doesn't mean you are inspired. You with me on this? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And then Vincent's like, this calls to mind the kind of filling of him as an empty pitcher. But what complicates it even more is, what is it you're filled with inspiration? What does the word come from? Yes, spirit, air, the invisible. Right? What's weird about inspiration is that it, I told you, every moment of this dialogue is really lit up. Let's see if we can draw Socrates. Big old Greek nose. Big beard, big messy hair, right? And there's our written text, right? When you're given a speech, when you're speaking versus reading, right? Here are words. Right? This is the spoken word, this is the written word. Right? The written word, what's strange about the written word, right, is that it doesn't involve any air. There's no spirit. There's no inspiration. The inspiration is air. Right? It's the spirit entering you. Right? Unlike the written word. Right? And this is really what's at stake for the written word versus the spoken word. This is what Socrates is going to constantly kind of break down, or Plato is going to constantly break down. That if you're inspired, you couldn't be inspired if you're writing. You can only be inspired if you're speaking. Because then you're closer to spirit, to the invisible world. You're further from the flesh of the world. Right? If the written word is flesh, right? If we saw it with Phaedrus, you know, Socrates says, whip out your speech, whip out your writing. It's the body. It's not just the body, it's the basis part of the body, right? That the spoken word, it's self-present. It's just you. It's you closer to spirit, closer to truth, closer to the invisible world. Does this make some sense? Yeah. How come words are coming out of his nose? Oh, because it's air. It's all the same. Look at me. I think with my nose, right? It's all the same, right? It's your site of aspiration. All right. Socrates says, then listen to me in silence. This place gives me the impression of being divine. The speech, I often seem to be in a frenzy. Don't be surprised. And you're the cause of it. And he says, and we must return to address the boy. Really weird, man. I mean, they're playing out a really bizarre sort of psychosexual drama right in front of us, right? Where it's kind of deferred flirtation. I'll tell you a story about seducing you. Right? And that's what's going on here. I'll address the boy, and it will come up again later rather explicitly. All right, so he gives the same speech, basically. And then, so jump ahead, 22. He stops. Peter's just like, you got to keep going, buddy. And Sag's like, nah. That's enough. It's all the same crap. What am I going to do? Just keep listing crap. So why say more? He says, this being so, my little tale can be left to the fate it deserves. Now I'm going to get out of here. And Peter says, it's kind of hot. Wait for it to cool off. And Socrates says, your attitude towards discourse, Phaedrus, is really wonderful and sublime. I'm sure that of the speeches made in your lifetime, no one has produced more than you, either delivering them yourself or in some way or other forcing others to deliver. I make an exception of Simmias the Theban. The others you surpass by far. And at the moment, it's evident that you have become responsible for yet another spoken by me. Again, this very strange ventriloquist moment. I'm speaking, but you're the cause. Right? So Socrates is literally playing the dummy, right? Like an empty pitcher. Right? Something else is speaking through him. No, you don't end quotation marks if you keep talking.
But then there's another one that starts on everyone.
Right, that's how quotation marks work. That's like classic grammar. You might want to read into that. That's how grammar works.
Okay.
I got a little talk with your debate club there, teach you guys a little grammar. Okay. So again, Socrates saying, it ain't me, it's you. Right? And of course, Phaedrus is constantly sort of bullied by Socrates, isn't he? Socrates will say, isn't that right, Phaedrus? Yeah. Right? They'll constantly have this game of mutual ventriloquism. Socrates' words come out of Phaedrus, Phaedrus' words come out of Socrates. They're constantly, you know, ventriloquizing, and I don't know. You get the idea. Okay. And then Socrates, the nutbag, says, my friend, when I was about to cross the river, there came to me the divine familiar sign which always holds me back from something I'm about to do. I thought I heard a voice which forbade me to go away until I had made atonement for an impiety to heaven. Well, this is strange. Right? The first time he gives a speech, he doesn't take responsibility for it. You can say, well, he didn't want to take responsibility for it because it was impious. It was a sinful speech. Right? He argued against the God of love. So he's like, of course I'm not going to take responsibility for it. But here comes his redemption, presumably, where he's going to recant what he said. But where does that voice come from? From him? No, he hears a voice. He hears a voice. He himself will always be at least double to himself. And in fact, that's what he'll argue. Right? To be human is to be composite. Right? Is to be two things. He'll make that explicit. He'll say to be mortal is to be a composite, to be a multiplicity. In that sense, you'll never just be univocal. You'll never just be self-present to yourself. You'll always be a multiplicity of voices stream through you. Okay? So here he is at his most pious moment. He's saying, I hear a voice. It's coming from elsewhere. He will never be self-present to himself. He himself is being written. He himself is a play of multiple voices. The voice comes to him. He's passive in this, yet it's in him. Right? It's such a strange position. It's a kind of this in-between position, right? Where he's being written almost as a play, and now he's responding like a character in the play that is him in his own head. Right? A voice speaks to him, he responds. It's like a dialogue. That's happening inside of him. It's always exhausting doing this dialogue. That's why I like the short texts. They're easier and sexier, but that's why I think it's good to do a long one. It's like a workout. We end with a workout. And I kind of secretly like that when you have to do this text again in classical rhetoric, you'll never be able to read it again the same way. But somebody will give you like a classical reading of it, and you won't be able ever to skip all the naughty parts, all the little performative parts. But this reading will stick with you. And I kind of enjoy that. All right. So Socrates is like, listen, I gotta recant this thing. He says, it was a dreadful, dreadful speech. The one you bought, the one you forced me to deliver, it was fatuous, it concealed something impious. Socrates is like, what are you talking about? And Socrates says, well, don't you believe love, you know, love is a god, the son of Aphrodite? So it's said, and Socrates says, well, but not by Lysias, and not by the speech of yours, which was spoken by you through my bewitched mouth. I mean, that's the most explicit ventriloquism, right? But what's weird is the written word is always kind of a ventriloquist act. That's sort of what writing is. I mean, I keep reading aloud from this text. Isn't that a kind of ventriloquism? I'm the dummy for Plato. Right? Plato's got his hand on my butt, and he's making my mouth move. Right? But of course, I'm trying to go right back to him, stick my hand up Plato's butt, and make him speak. And so I'm giving my reading of this text is my way of speaking back to it. Right? So that to engage with the text is a kind of mutual and respective ventriloquism. I make it speak, it makes me speak. We make each other speak together. Does that make some sense? Right? So I'm not just the straight dummy of Plato. I'm kind of the dummy of him. Right? He's making the words come out of my mouth. But then I have this weird ability to inflect these words, to draw emphasis to some and not to others. Notice how I skip around. I amplify some, de-amplify others. That's my form of making Plato's text speak. Right? And so this is actually the one copy I've had for 10 years, teaching Rhetoric 10, or I guess 5 years, teaching Rhetoric 10, right, with all my notes. Right? If I lose this, I'm screwed because then I'd have to reread it. So this way I never have to reread it. All my notes are in here. But notice, why don't I underline every passage? I only underline some. That's my kind of speaking back to the text, of amplifying certain points and not others. Right? A different reader of this text would talk about different things. They'd emphasize other ones. I skipped over certain things that kind of, I know, interest people, like Phaedrus says, friend to friend. The notion of a friend in Greek culture, in Greek philosophy, is an important notion. Right? What is a friend? Right? Because it establishes the terms of discourse, to be a friend as opposed to an enemy, as opposed to a civilian. Something about friendship suggests a certain kind of generosity towards discourse, towards discoursing with somebody. But I skipped over that. Didn't interest me. But you could give multiple readings. My point being, again, that as I speak Plato, I'm his dummy. He's the ventriloquist. As I inflect it and only read certain passages, I speak back. Right? Same thing's happening here with Socrates and Phaedrus, right? It's a hilarious moment. Not by Lysias, not by that speech of yours, which was spoken by you through my bewitched mouth. Right? So listen, he says, love's a god. If we agree that love's a god, we gotta change our tune here. We gotta begin again. Right? So skip to the next page. Oh yeah, maybe we'll get to the beginning of his speech. Because this second speech is a big one. So at the bottom he says, I'm sure of that, as long as you continue to be our Phaedrus, then you may confidently proceed. And this question of whether Phaedrus is consistent to himself, right? Socrates says, as long as you're my Phaedrus, as long as you remain Phaedrus, this is how you'll be. But of course, Phaedrus does go through a conversion in this text. Right? He moves from rhetoric to philosophy. Is he still Phaedrus? Has Phaedrus lost track of himself? I don't know. Socrates says, and this again, this weird moment, this weird play within a play. He says, where is that boy I was addressing? This too he must hear and not slip off to yield to his non-lover before he listens to what I have to say. Oh, it's such a weird moment. Who is the non-lover? Is it Socrates or is it Lysias? It's very strange. He argues that Lysias is in fact the real lover. They're lovers. Right? Phaedrus and Lysias are lovers. They have sex. Right? They're boyfriends. Right? Socrates and Phaedrus are not. Socrates is the non-lover. In one way. In another way, Lysias is the non-lover. Right? Because he doesn't actually love. It's lust. He's a man of the body. He's a man of words, of language, of rhetoric. And Socrates is a man of love. So while he's a non-lover in one sense of Lysias, he is in fact, of Phaedrus, he is in fact the lover of Phaedrus in another sense. In the sense that he loves him in this other notion of love. Right? So when he says about this boy, that he must hear not slip off to yield to his non-lover before he listens to what I have to say. He's speaking again multiply. He's speaking in two ways at the same time. Right? It's not really a pun as much as it's ironic. He means it and doesn't mean it, and he means it in two different ways that keep reversing themselves. Sometimes that means Lysias, sometimes it means Socrates. It means both of them, depending on how you look at it. And this second speech is going to be identical to the first speech, but he's going to shift the way you look at it. They're really the same arguments, right? He says, yeah, the lover's nuts. The lover's nuts. And the first one, he says it's not good to be nuts. And the second one, he says it is good to be nuts. Depends how you look at it. Does he say he's going to take it off?
Yeah.
Or he says he'll do the second one uncovered. Yeah, I see where you're going there.
In particular, you can point to that passage on the top of the page where he says, I shall attempt to atone to him for my, with my recantation.
Ah, there it is.
This time with bared head, not as before, veiled in shame. So if before he says that he's veiling his head to not get distracted, he's kind of rewriting it in this moment, saying, before it was because I was veiled in shame.
Right, right. Good. Before we, we got to do Phaedrus's obscene reply, right? Socrates is like, where is that boy I was addressing, right? And just to make sure that there's a conflation of what's happening between them and the story he's telling within his speech, right? So there's the story of, between Phaedrus and Socrates, then there's the story within Socrates' speech, right? And just to make sure they're intimately interconnected, Socrates says, where's the boy we were addressing in the speech? Phaedrus says, he's right beside you. Very close. Always present when you want him. He's a naughty little flirt, this Phaedrus. Right? But at that point, Phaedrus becomes the boy in the story, just in case there was any ambivalence. Right? About, is it the story? Is it Phaedrus? It's made quite clear there. Right before we get into the second speech, what is interesting about the fact that there is a second speech? Good, say more. Just say that again. What do you mean, each part?
It shows Socrates' rhetorical play of each part. It shows his ambiguity in he has a privilege one side versus the other.
Yeah. And he's playing the rhetorician, right? That if, you know, the classical rhetorical strategy, right, that in the schools of sophistry, you were taught you had to give one side of an argument and then give the other side. You probably still do that, right? In debate, it's how you train. Shouldn't matter what side you give. You can give any side, right? You don't go for the side you believe in. You go for the side you're assigned.
Yeah.
Right? Which means you have to be able to argue the other side.
And of course, you can kind of go back and forth.
Right. Right. And you have to learn the other side, right? And so the classical mode of rhetoric was you should be able to argue any side. We saw a little bit in Dissologoi who kind of multiplies that because he makes many sides to any given occasion. Right? But the classical rhetorical argument or strategy is it doesn't matter what you believe in. You should be able to argue anything. We know this about the contemporary rhetor, the lawyer, the defense attorney. Right? He can argue any case. Right? It doesn't really matter He's not tethered to a truth or a moral code. He's tethered to the case, which means he might have to argue both sides at different times of his life. Yeah.
And it kind of goes along this whole thing. They go back and forth. Like, you know you. If I don't know you, then I don't know myself. Kind of going along the lines of, like, you have to know, knowing oneself is knowing the other.
Yeah,
and
very nice.
You know,
wow.
Truly
that's pretty smart. I like that, right? That to know oneself is actually comes through dialogue, through exchange with someone else. Right? That if yourself is always already this multiple thing, then to come to know the thing that's multiple is to engage in multiplicity. I like that. There was another hand somewhere. No? Okay. All right, so Socrates, just structurally, if you step back and you kind of put aside the narrative for a moment, that the second speech is a recantation, right? Or does that make sense? If you put that aside and say, okay, the second speech isn't just a recanting. If you just look at it structurally, Socrates argues one side, Socrates argues the other side. Right? He performs, in a sense, the role of the classical rhetorician. He argues both sides of the case. Now, he might privilege one over the other, but the fact of the matter is he is capable of arguing both sides, and in fact does argue both sides. So just by stepping back, you just look at the dialogue, you look at what happens, how of this dialogue, you see him perform the job of a rhetorician. You see him perform as rhetorician, arguing both sides of the case. Unlike the self-righteous district attorney who believes in the law and the truth, Socrates here plays the defense attorney. He can argue both sides. He's not tethered to a moral code. He's capable of arguing anything. Working it out. I know, I'm giving you guys a lot. That's why I wanted to start this early, make sure you're all ready for your finals. Okay, so Socrates' second speech. Again, the strange moment where that can't possibly be spoken, that only exists for us visually, right? Socrates doesn't say Socrates' second speech. It's a weird typographic moment. It's a weird textual moment. The first paragraph is hilarious to me, and then I'll let you guys go. He says, "Now you must understand, fair youth, that the last speech was that of Phaedrus, son of Pythocles from Myrinus. But the one I'm about to deliver is by Stesichorus, son of Euphemus from Himera." All right, there's so many weird things here. First of all, who the fuck, right? It's Stesichorus, right? It's not him speaking again. This is his recantation. This should be his pious speech. But it's not by him. He never takes responsibility for anything. I don't know anything, says Socrates. I don't know. This isn't from me. He's speaking, but he's not speaking. He's speaking, but he's not speaking. He's speaking, but he's not speaking. That's constantly his mode. He speaks, but it's not my words. He's speaking and not speaking. It's dialogic.
Stesichorus was mentioned on the previous page, and he's a poet.
Is that right? Absolutely, yeah. Yes, yeah. That was very good, right. That's where we're headed right now, right? And it gets even weirder, right? Now, you know, again, somebody would probably yell at me from a classical perspective saying I'm making too much of it, but his name is, right? Right? That it just has a chorus, right? That there is a kind of chorus here. There's going to be this multiplicity of voices speaking. And where is it from? And this is like a joke. Why is this funny? Why is this interesting to us? That it's from Euphemus. What's a euphemism?
Nicer way of saying something.
Say that again?
Nicer way of saying something,
but it's also a way of not speaking directly. Of not quite saying what you mean. That's what a euphemism is. Right? You don't want to say the person died, so you say they passed. What the fuck, they passed? What do you mean they passed? Right? doesn't actually mean anything. They walk by me? What do you mean they passed? It's a way of saying, not saying what you want to say. Indirectly saying what you want to say. indirectly saying what you want to say. You want to know another strategy, another tactic for not saying, for saying indirectly what you want to say? It's called irony. Right? You don't quite say what you mean, but you do mean it. You mean something else. You mean the ironic moment. You mean irony. When you speak ironically, it's not just that you mean you don't mean your words, you do mean your words. What you mean to say is everything that you're saying and how you're saying it. You mean irony when you speak ironically. You don't mean what you're saying. You give the whole relationship between the what and the how. You indirectly say something. Right? Irony is necessarily a kind of indirection. Right? Kierkegaard is obsessed with this notion of indirection, precisely because it's the great problem of the body of Jesus. Right? Jesus can't, he has to speak indirectly. He's God, but he's a man. How can he speak divinely? It's very complicated. He comes in incognito. He has to come in incognito, because what would he look like if he were God? He couldn't look like anything. So Jesus is an indirect path. He's always a little indirect. You can only speak indirectly of the truth. Right? So here's Socrates speaking euphemistically. Yeah.
It's also worth pointing out since the issue of paternity comes up, his son.
Oh, yes, very good, very good, very good. Right. We'll come back to the bastard thing and who's son of whom. Very good. But what's nice about euphemism is not the same as irony. It's a different kind of indirection. But what it makes you wonder, when you speak euphemistically, you've said something in a nice way that you didn't really mean. Right? Or maybe you meant. Right? So it makes us wonder, when he speaks against rhetoric and in favor of philosophy, does he really mean it? Right? When he's censuring something or praising it, does he really mean it? Or is he just speaking euphemistically? Right? Is he speaking indirectly, trying to actually tell us something else? All right. Finish this dialogue over the weekend. Next week, by Thursday, we'll give you the final questions. They'll be about Phaedrus. And